I'm going to move considerably faster today than I did yesterday because I simply don't want to waste a lot of the material I prepared, and that's not just because I did it. It's because I think a lot of the material would jog your thinking a little bit and perhaps be good to think about. Point number 8 that we're ready for this morning is simply that elders must be organized people. Point A under that, that means then that the activities of the church, the classes, the things that happen, should be well organized. This doesn't mean he has to do all this organizing. It only means that he should know that they are. I have sat in classes with disorganized teachers, and the results are minimal. But organization helps us all learn. We are all systematic thinkers, even though we may not know it. And we do grasp things better that are presented to us in some kind of systematic order. And this is important for elders to understand and to insist on in the activities under their supervision. Point B, when an elder is planning something, an organized mind will ask a number of questions. What needs to be included in this? How may people react to this? What might be the consequence of this? In other words, we need to do some logical, organized thinking before we attempt something. We don't want to be like the man who jumped on his horse and rode off in all directions in our thinking. We want to be systematic. We want to be logical. And we need also not to miss details that may be pertinent. In other words, I don't want to say after something started, well, I wish I had thought of such and such, or if I'd only thought of that. We'd rather not do that because that really doesn't help us when it's too late. Point C, this also refers to making announcements, talking to the church about anything. Do this in an organized, systematic manner. And I notice that both of the elders here are to be highly commended in this area. And if I can hand you a rose, I will. Both are well organized when they give announcements. Both say no more than is necessary. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Point D, they need to be organized individually in their lives because elders are not full-time. They all earn a living at other things. And if they're not organized, they cannot make wise use, judicious use, if you will, of the time they have for the affairs of the church. So a disorganized person, simply, in the time he had, might not accomplish very much, where a person with an organized mind, having a little time, can accomplish quite a lot. So an elder really needs this. He needs this badly if he's going to accomplish his job well. All right, ready for point number 9. And generally speaking, the elder must be a person who wears well. And I'll explain what I mean by this. Point A, he is not to be an abrasive person. Sometimes we have a tendency to rub people the wrong way just by the way we talk, perhaps just by our facial expression. I know some brethren who seem to be challenging me every time I talk to them, but they don't know it. I don't think they're even aware of this. But it's the facial expression, it's the tone of voice that seems almost, I double dare you to say anything. This kind of approach bothers people. So he has to have an approach that in no way is an affront to people, in no way upsets them, or in any way offends or upsets them. So he just simply can't be abrasive. And I think the word gentle, used in 1 Timothy 3, is the key to that. A gentle approach probably will not be abrasive. An elder has to be a kind man, a really nice person, kind and forgiving. Ephesians 5:32. We all should be like that. But because he is talking to so many people, because he has to deal with a number of things, this kind of an attitude is a godsend. He is kind and forgiving in nature. This will be a great asset. He has to have, point C, a genuine love and interest in people. This can't be a feigned love, a pretended. It has to be genuine. He has to have an honest interest in people. You can't push this, you can't do this well if it isn't real. I have seen door-to-door salesmen who were afraid to sell. They didn't have confidence in their product, and when they came to the door, they didn't really expect to sell anything. I've seen others who came very confidently, very sure of themselves, believing in the product, all ready to sell you, all prepared and determined to sell you. So I think a genuine interest, a genuine love, will give us some persistence. It will give us some courage. It will give us, I think, whatever we need to walk into that situation and deal with it. Because if I have this love or interest, I don't want to see people go wrong. I don't want to see them hurt. I don't want to see them stray. I want them to remain in the fold of safety. And if I have that love and interest showing by my manner, in my voice, and in what I say when I approach you, I may get a positive reaction. Point D, I believe that when you're with an elder, you should feel good. Do you know what I mean by that? You just feel good with this person. Now, I have had associations with a lot of people. We go out to lunch together. We go somewhere and talk. And this is magnified many times over in different activities. Sometimes we can be with a person quite a while but never really feel good. I think it means that we don't have a meeting of minds. We don't have the instinctive feeling that we have a person here who only means well or good to me. I feel just a little uncomfortable. Maybe I feel a little bit threatened. But an elder should be a person that you feel good with, even after considerable association. And that should be a feeling that doesn't change after considerable association. Point E, he's just plain nice to be with. Just a pleasant experience to spend time with an elder. And I would say in most of my relationships with elders, this has been the case. It is a very pleasant experience because they are just thoroughly nice people. Point F. In order to be that very nice person, he should be a sensible talker. He is careful of extreme or upsetting views. Now, not that he can't introduce something that you aren't familiar with, not that he can't tell you something you don't know, but he simply must be careful how he presents it. Because most of us don't like too many shocks. We would rather be handled gently, sometimes even with kid gloves. And if an elder knows that I am a little sensitive in an area anyway, and he wants to talk to me, then his approach should reflect a little caution. It should indicate that he understands me to some extent and knows at least a little about what he's getting into. In other words, he has to have a sensitivity to people. This will help him immensely in his dealings with them. G, he has to be a good listener. And by a good listener, I would explain it this way. He has to appear to be listening only to you and giving you his full attention. That's a good listener. If you are trying to talk to an elder and you see that his attention is on other things, this is not satisfying at all. But if you talk to him and his attention is fully on you, he's looking at you, he's listening to you, he's giving you his full attention, then that is a pleasing experience. Now, in all your dealings with people, you have seen some that are evasive just in their manner, even when they're talking with you. An elder cannot be evasive in this way. He has to have I don't know whether you're familiar with this term, but the Europeans talked about he has to have a full face. Now, what they mean by this is that you are to see the front of his face, his eyes, his nose, his mouth. In other words, he is talking to you face to face. This is what they meant by that. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be 6 inches apart, because remember that the person you're talking to and spatial relationships are related. We talk to people we're very affectionate with, usually, nose to nose. When we're dealing with a matter between two people who may like each other very much, that spatial relationship generally extends a little farther. And that, I think, can be, well, that's an area that I don't want to get into, but because that's an area that has a lot of information of its own and some techniques and other things that go with it. And we don't have time to do that, but this should be observed and considered. If a person backs away from you when you get close to them, it means they want more space. It means they're nervous being that close to you. Give them the space. Let everyone choose his own space, in other words, is what I'm saying. When an elder talks to a person, if he doesn't move, is pleased to stand there, then maintain that space. But judge by what the person does. Number 10 in this outline, he must have dignity. An elder absolutely must have dignity. A dignity is a form of reserve of manner and language. It's a form of reserve connected very closely to self-control and peace of mind. He must project the right image. And this image is not the same for everybody. The Jewish elders projected a fatherly image. And that is not a bad image at all for an elder. Because in a sense, he is a father figure. He is more like a patriarch in actuality. More like a family patriarch. Do you know what I mean by this? When the patriarch was the head of the family, this was prior to the law of Moses, the system that was used, the patriarch was consulted on family decisions. He had the final word in family decisions. So an elder is very similar to a patriarch in terms of his relationship with the congregation. And if we understand this relationship, I don't think it's going to be unpleasant, not if we use it properly. B, a person must be an individual whom you take seriously. In other words, you instinctively know that this man is not a lightweight. You feel that he's not a pushover. You feel, you sense the authority in the man. Now, any of you who have ever taught school know that when a person who has this characteristic walks into a classroom, the kids feel it. They sense it. They know it's there. And any teacher who has that has a leg up on the others who don't have it. I have seen teachers walk into classrooms, very intelligent people, highly skilled, well-trained, and just be devastated by their reception because they just seemed like pushovers to the kids, marshmallows, jellyfish. Just seemed like there was nothing to restrain there at all. Now, I think I don't like to use a personal example any better than anyone else, but I have been told by many people that this is the air I have. I have an air of authority. I didn't have any problem controlling students in the classroom, so perhaps I have. I don't know. And we don't all possess this to the same degree. But I know that our Lord Jesus had this quality because he spoke as one who had authority. Even though he was mild, even though he was gentle, he nonetheless emanated authority. You heard it in his speech. You saw it in the way he stood. You heard it in the way he expressed himself, his choice of words. The authority just simply permeated everything he did in a very gentle, mild way. And if an elder has that, that is a tremendous asset. You take that person seriously, and you listen soberly to what he has to say. You do that instinctively. Point C, an elder must be worthy of your respect. Now we know from what the Scripture tells us that we have every right to esteem an elder highly in love for his work's sake. And if that's the attitude we have toward our elders, their relationships with us are going to be easy. Not going to be any strain or unpleasantness. Because the people that I esteem highly, I enjoy talking to. And I will always listen well to the people I esteem highly. I never turn them off. Because we know that what they say is never intended to hurt us. And if it has to hurt, it's for our good, not for ill. So the word recognize that is used in the Scripture, recognize those, means to acknowledge or take as clear examples, to take notice of with approbation or with favor. In other words, to recognize as good, honest, conscientious, hard-working people. Not just know who they are, but recognize what they are. This is what the word actually means. It's also to acknowledge as having a particular status. It's also to acknowledge as one entitled to be heard. So in that word acknowledge, there is a wide scope, and it clearly indicates respect. When you add it up, that's what it means, respect. And an elder must be worthy of that respect, that esteem from the congregation because of the person he is. Point number 11. I mentioned this before, but I want to go into it just a little bit more right now. He must be an astute student of human nature. Point A, he must never embarrass people in what he asks them to do. And that means that a person who is not ready to do something should not be asked to do it. Now, I'm not talking about the nervousness that might accompany your first effort at something. This is not what I mean. That's not embarrassment. That's just a little nervousness at being up front or taking perhaps a little responsibility you're not accustomed to. I'm talking about embarrassment, which is humiliating to the individual. We don't, in other words, want to make someone look bad before other members of the congregation if there is any way we can avoid it. Now, I don't mean that we can't correct someone publicly if we have to. But look bad when we don't need to. This is what I'm talking about. When there isn't any reason for it, when there's no call for it. We just simply do not want to embarrass people if we can help it. B, we must never compare people in the church, one to the other. That, said Paul to the Corinthians, is not wise. And why isn't it wise? Because we are all unique individuals, that's why. There is no basis for comparison, really. We might compare efforts, we might compare test scores, but in comparing one whole person to another, there is no basis for comparison if each of us is different. And since we are, we should be intelligent enough not to do this. Because just as Rick was talking about the danger of doing this with children, we have the same danger in the church. We're told in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 14, "For in fact the body is not one member, but many." And who made it that way? God. God set the members in the body as He wished. He wants diversity. He wants us all different, because that's the strength of the organization. He doesn't want us all to think alike. He wants sometimes some divergence of views, because that's what challenges and keeps us awake intellectually. God doesn't want a stale, dead atmosphere where never a spark shows. And the diversity accomplishes God's purpose. He planned it that way, and it works that way. Point C, elders must study the techniques of motivation. I think of all the things that they might read, this might be one of the most fruitful. Read material on how to motivate people, how to make people want to do things. Because there are ways to do this. There are techniques that one can learn. We don't want people in the church, for example, like the third servant mentioned in Matthew 25:25, who simply hid his talent. We simply don't want servants of God like that, because that servant, unfortunately, will have his portion with those who try to hide from God and gnash their teeth. He was an unprofitable servant. God doesn't admire that kind of servant and doesn't save them, incidentally. We want to be like the first or second servant. And if I'm not really sure of my abilities, I'm a little uncertain as to what I can do, I think if an elder walks up to me and says, "I believe that you can handle," and he names whatever it is, "I think you could handle that well. I'll help you, and if you need some other help, we have people here who can advise you and help you. Would you like to have a go at it? Would you like to try it? I really think you can do it." That's just one motivational technique. There are many others, and again, this is an area that would be great for us to study, but it isn't relevant right here. There is a great lesson in Matthew 25, verse 29, a tremendous lesson. "For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away." You see the reason for motivation. You see why it's so desperately needed. Because the person who has, that's the individual who's willing to work, who's willing to do things, who has many good works to his credit, the person who has will have abundance because of his willingness, because of his desire to serve. He will accumulate much more in the treasury of God. But the person who doesn't have, the person who has that paucity of good works will find even what he has taken away. There is one stern, important lesson in that scripture. Point number 12 on the outline. An elder needs to be objective and honest with the congregation. Objective and honest with the congregation. A, if there is something wrong, he says so, without apology, because that is his job. He should never apologize for what the Lord has appointed him to do. there's something wrong, he simply says so. He doesn't mince words, but he states objectively and honestly what it is. He won't misrepresent the case. He'll be objective, he'll be honest in saying what's wrong. B, and I want you to listen to this very carefully. If a member's performance is lackluster and the member is capable of doing much better, the elder must not pretend the performance was good. Did you hear what I said? If an elder walks up to you and says to you, you can do better than that, you let the church down, you take that like a young woman or a young man, because he's probably telling you the truth. We should not compliment people who do poor jobs. We are doing them a great disservice. Also, we are afflicting the congregation. We do a disservice to the individual because we erroneously are reinforcing the idea that a poor job is all right, and it is not. A lack of preparation is deplorable on the part of a Christian when he is assigned to do something. He should never be complimented for a half-done job. God won't compliment us for that. Why should I mislead you into believing that half-done work is good when God won't accept it? Why should we accept it? We should compliment people who genuinely tried to do their best and commiserate with people who didn't do well. Sympathize with them, but for heaven's sakes, don't tell them they did well, because they didn't. An elder must be honest, objective, and he may have to tell you something sometime you don't like to hear. If he says, son, you're dragging your feet, you're sloughing off, listen, because he knows what he's talking about, and he's talking to you honestly for your own good. Now, that's hard to do, admittedly, but it needs to be done. I have often wondered why a person would be fired for a sloppy job at work, but we commend a sloppy job highly in the church. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Because God will only accept our best. Do you think for one minute that it's any different now? God would not accept a crippled animal. He wouldn't accept a lame one. He wouldn't accept an imperfect one. And he won't accept anything for me except my best. Half best will never get me to heaven. Only the very best I can do will get me there. And that should be understood by every single member of the church. An elder should never let the church forget that, individually and collectively, because that's the truth. Point C, if an elder sees a member adversely affecting others, and this happens a lot, you sit between a couple of people and they want to talk across you, and you can't hear it thunder. Or two people behind you just keep shuffling their feet, just keep kicking the back of the seat, just keep it up, until you're so distracted you can't think straight. Or somebody talks to somebody else all the way through the Lord's Supper. We see a lot of people in the church who, for some reason or other, don't seem to be able to sit still, listen, and not bother other people. And these aren't all young people. I've seen some older women who couldn't keep quiet in the church too. I've seen some men who couldn't resist talking when they should have been quiet. If an elder sees this, and this becomes a pattern for that person, he should tell the person about it. Your behavior is not proper in the house of God. when we're together. We're here to worship, not to gossip. We're here to honor God, not inform each other. And that should be clearly understood. You see, elders have a very difficult job because they have to talk honestly and objectively with people. They can't resort to the subterfuges that we do. They can't beat all around the bush and never come around to the front like we do. We can't half express something and confuse people because that's not good communication. But an elder, by his very position, because he is a watchman, he isn't going to come to you and tell you there's no danger when the place is about to blow up. He has to be honest with you. And if I can't stand as a member of the church for an elder to be honest with me, I've got some hard work to do on my attitude. I'm at fault if I can't take honest speech. The elder is not. He is doing his job as God appointed it to him. Next point, and last one in this section. If a member fails to carry out an obligation, we should try, if we can, to find out why. What happened? Is this the nature of the person never to complete anything? Or did something get in the way? People don't always fail because they want to, because they're careless or neglectful. Sometimes they fail because they can't help it. So, in a situation where someone fails, and I'm not speaking of something public here, but something private, something that we might have attempted to do, if we fail in a matter like that, it is wise to find out why before we say any more. Sometimes obstacles are real, sometimes they're imaginary. If they're imaginary, perhaps we can be more directive, but if they're real, we should be sympathetic. We should understand. Point number 13, an elder must have a good sense of timing. A, if a person is willing to work today, put him to work. Don't wait a week. If someone comes up to you and says, "Can I help?" put him to work. Because next week, he may not be willing. Strike while the iron is hot. Let him work. Give him work when he wants it, when he expresses a desire to do it. B, if a few members, and some of you can identify with this, if a few members have been discussing something among themselves that they would like to do, and the elder is aware of that, now is the time to talk about it. While it is fresh on their minds, is the best time. And this is true also in point C. For example, if you have members who come back from a meeting and are enthusiastic, that's a good time to talk about having a meeting like that yourself, isn't it? While you have some enthusiastic supporters. See, that's timing, a sense of timing, a sense of when is the right time to do this? When is the appropriate time? Is this the right time or is this the wrong time? That sense of timing, that sense of knowing when it's most appropriate is very, very useful to an elder. Can be of great help to him sometimes in suggesting things, courses of action to the congregation. Point D, if someone has made a mistake, deal with it immediately. Deal with it immediately. That's the easiest time to deal with it. And just as you discipline a child, as you heard this morning, as quickly as possible, It is the same in the church with mistakes that we make. Address it immediately if you can. There is a reason for this. Most of us, when we have made a mistake, in a little while we'll have begun to rationalize it. It's hard to resist that. We will begin, if we don't rationalize it, we will at the very least begin to see it in a different light after we've thought about it a while. That again is human nature. We seem to have these self-defense mechanisms built in. We have to resist them along with our other nature. We have to deny them the right to influence us. But because these processes set in, if I talk to you very quickly after you made the mistake, you haven't had time to set up these defenses yet, and I'm far more likely to get you to admit honestly what you've done. This is why a good lawyer will try to surprise a witness to make him admit something before his defense mechanisms can click in. Because we're without those defenses for a little while. But some of them click in very fast. Some people set their defenses almost as fast as they make the mistake. A lady ran a red light and hit us in the side. She got out very apologetically. "I'm so sorry I hit you. I didn't mean to. I was looking the other way." 3 minutes later, when the city police got there, we were to blame. She'd had time to rationalize, to see it in a different light. And that is just natural in us. We change the circumstances. We see them differently. We set up these defenses. So the more quickly we can deal with a mistake, the more likely it is that a solution will be found. Point number 14 in the outline. An elder must understand what we call good psychology. Now, a lot of this is just plain common sense. What we call good psychology is just common sense, really. Now, Paul spoke to the Corinthians. You might look at chapter 9 of that book, verses 1 and 2. He's using just good common sense, but this is what we call good psychology. "Now, concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority." All right, this is good psychology, good common sense, because if he has boasted of them to other people, bragged about how willing they are to other congregations, and they don't follow through, you see, they have a lot of extra pressure on them now. He has very cleverly put them under a lot of pressure to give, simply because, he says, "I bragged about your willingness to other congregations." In other words, they're all expecting you to, because I told them you would. And how are we going to look now if we don't give? So the pressure is on us just by a little good psychology on Paul's part. And sometimes this will help us to get things done if we can apply this in subtle ways. You know, we're to be as wise as serpents. And the serpent beguiled Eve, did he not? We must know how to beguile a little bit. We're told to be that wise. Point B. Sometimes if we brag about someone's expertise in a small way, they will volunteer for a bigger, harder assignment. And I've seen this work many times. If I compliment you very much on your song leading, you may be willing to try a table talk now because I have built up your confidence. You'll be more willing to try something else. That's just good psychology, good common sense. Point C, sometimes a person can be talked into matching what someone else has done. We say, Now, you see, that person doesn't have a lot of ability, but you see, they did well with a little effort. Surely you can do that. In other words, just a little bit of matching. Because we all try to reciprocate, don't we? You pat me on the back, I pat you on the back. We have this kind of back and forth attitude, this kind of trade back and forth. And since that's common in people, we just use it to our advantage in hoping that we can get someone, perhaps, to do something who might have been reluctant before. We might even say to a person, if it's true, you might even be able to do it better because you seem to have a little more ability in this area. See, we can put a little sugar on the roll, make it a little sweeter, a little more palatable. Point D. Suppose I walk up to you and say, I have a project for a smart, talented person, and I thought immediately of you. I don't think you'll say no immediately, not unless I've tried this approach before. But we respond to compliments. We all respond to flattery, to compliments. And if it's sincere, there isn't one thing wrong with it. How do you think the church in Thessalonica felt when Paul said to them, from you sounded out the gospel all through Macedonia and Achaia. In fact, you've sounded it out so effectively, we don't need to say anything. How do you think that made them feel when they read that? That was a genuine, honest compliment. They were sitting on cloud nine when they read that. There's no doubt about it. Compliments motivate us because we all like approval. It's good for our self-concept, good for our ego. We eat it up. So use it. Point number 15. Elders must keep the congregation fully informed of things the members need to know. If someone writes a letter to the church asking for help, now this could be in a building, could be because of an emergency, it might be help for a very sick person who is in poor financial straits. Whatever it is, this is a matter that the elder should bring before the church. This should not be a private matter. And if there are later developments, if there are other communications, these also should be brought before the church. Because what we're talking about here is an expenditure of money which all of us have helped to contribute. In other words, we all have a little stake in this, so we should all know what's going on. We should all be fully informed. B, if there is a necessary expenditure that involves future plans, an addition to the building, something we're going to improve, this should always be a matter for the entire congregation, for the same reason I mentioned below. We simply don't want anyone in the dark as to what we're attempting to do that might benefit all of us in some way. Point number C, if there are movements in the brotherhood that the congregation here should know, has there been a problem in a particular place? Have there been a number of conversions in a particular place? Whether it's good news or bad news, we need to feel that we are involved in the entire brotherhood, that we're not isolated. Now, Paul wanted this because he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, that he wanted churches to share. Now, he was talking specifically here about money because he believed that one congregation shouldn't be destitute and another rich. He wanted a sharing to take place among the churches to help in time of need. But that sharing, I think, can be extended also to information and other matters. I know some congregations feel almost isolated. That's not a good feeling. We need to feel that we're an integral, working, important cog in the great wheel of brotherhood. If there are problems in the church, it is not inappropriate at all for an elder to simply say to the congregation, "Brethren, we have problems." and lay it on the line as to what they are and what we need to do. I don't think, if it's a problem that affects a number of people, that this should be a private matter. I think in that case it needs to be a public matter. Now, if we're dealing with something that only affects one or two, then of course we handle it privately. But if it affects several, if there are some people who have been given wrong ideas, if someone has been talking out of turn, talk to several people, this has to be handled as a congregational matter. So we bring the congregation into this discussion. We talk about it publicly. If an action has been taken by elders that is not understood by the members, and there will be actions at times taken to the elders that members are not all aware of. These will be small matters, usually routine matters, things that are their business primarily, that need not necessarily be brought before the congregation and discussed. If something done that way is not understood